Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm your host, Ray Graff. We talk birds today as we do once a month. Rich Guthrie is here to help answer your questions about birds. He's a veteran birder, a former NCON specialist. Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also comment on the Vox Pop page of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. Check in on Facebook at facebook.com/WAMC Radio or tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Rich, always nice to have you here. Welcome back, buddy.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Lovely day for the birds, eh?
It is, and it's, the show has just begun.
Yes, indeed. You know, I was reading in the lower the paper downstate in Westchester. They had a nice article about the return of several, pairs of blue heron down in a swamp in Bedford, New York.
Okay.
And I guess it's a big deal that there were so many of them. I remember I lived down there for a couple of years, and right in that area, and there used to be one that would pop in the pond where I lived often. But apparently there are at least two or three pairs down there.
Well, here's what, with great blue herons in our area, first of all, they're very conspicuous whenever they're around. They look like, when they're in the air, they look like a new age pterodactyl.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're on the ground, of course, they're tall, they're slinky, they stand out in the open by the water's edge, waiting for a frog or a fish to come by.
Mm-hmm.
And they're conspicuous.
Yeah.
When they nest, and they nest in fairly large colonies, it's not just one, there's 12, 21.
Yep.
They tend to find a secluded swamp, a nest on the tops of the tallest trees.
Yeah.
A great big stick nest. So they're kind of hard to miss. When they do show up and find a suitable swamp to set up housekeeping, they are there. I mean, big time there.
But there are many in this region, right?
Yeah, they are. They're not uncommon. You could look up almost any time of the day this time of year and see a great blue heron somewhere between you and the horizon.
All right, well, let's go. As a matter of fact, this is serendipity. Let's go to our phones at 1-800-348-2551. I think Susan has a question. Susan in Albany, you're on the same topic as we are.
I am, and I have been in a quest to see them ever since I saw those nests on Round Lake, but they were empty, and we just spent Sunday starting on the Mohawk and working our way almost to Vermont with people said, oh, just go a mile east and you'll see them. We saw none.
So none.
I was trying to find out. Five stops, and the nests were huge. Somebody said in September they mate in a particular place, but
no.
Where's the optimal place? And you have to go in by water, because I know on the tributary for Round Lake you had to go in by water.
Okay, there are other places where they are visible from the highway. And up in your neck of the woods, Round Lake, for those in the Springfield area, is around Saratoga Springs, New York. It's between Albany and Saratoga Springs. And I know there's a great place just east of the Saratoga Battlefields National Monument off Route 4 and 40 that you could look off the highway and see a rather large colony of great blue herons that I believe is active. And there are other places. If you're down in the New Paltz, New York area, down in Ulster County, there's a colony visible from the New York State Thruway in Estate 87. And
yeah. We were at the one east of the battlefield around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We didn't see nests, and we didn't see any activity. We went further east up to, there's a little mini falls up there, And the thing was that at the wrong time of day? Is it only morning? Well, you know, but we didn't see the nest.
Well, the nest themselves, the stick platforms shouldn't go anywhere. So the birds may be off finding lunch. I actually, now you inspire me to go up there and have a look for myself. But to my knowledge, there's no shortage of great blue herons in the area. There are several active nest colonies out and about. What they need is first of all, they need some quiet, set-aside place, a little quiet corner of the world, and usually that involves some sort of a beaver pond with some good, healthy, standing dead trees so that they could build their nest on top of.
Okay. Well, Susan, yeah, good luck, and give us a call next time. Let us know if you had any luck.
And I'll give a run up there myself. I'm driven to find out.
Okay, fair enough. Rich Guthrie is our guest. We talk birds today on Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551. Jake in Ackard. Jake, you're on.
Where are the hummingbirds?
They're on their way.
They're very, very late. I mean,
you're right about that. And that has been a widespread topic of conversation amongst backyard birders in the Northeast.
Uh-huh.
And you're not alone there. They're at least a week behind schedule, but they are. We're now, just yesterday and today, getting our first reports of our hummingbirds returning to backyards.
I hope so.
Was it weather that kept them?
Yeah, apparently it is weather. Usually weather is not a big factor in terms of the grand scale of bird migration. Mm-hmm. But apparently this year, there are a number of factors that extend all the way back into midwinter that has affected the movement of birds this spring.
Hmm.
And particularly down south of us, the Texas Gulf Coast and the Gulf of Mexico. I can't speak of Central and South America, but in any event, there has been a huge climatological block out there that has kept the birds south of us, and all of them, not just the hummingbirds, all of our familiar songsters are trickling in at a very slow behind schedule rate.
Is it because things have been cold?
It's more than cold. Rainy,
yeah.
Cold and rainy.
Huh.
And adverse winds. The winds don't have to be chilly. They just have, if they're going in the wrong direction, the birds are not going to take advantage of it. They're not going to work against it.
I see. Jake, you good on that?
Yeah, no, I just one other question. Something. I think there should be a law that they shouldn't be able to sell such large hummingbird feeders, because the sugar water really needs to be changed every 3 days.
You're right about that.
And it's like people will buy these huge feeders, and they're killing off the hummingbirds.
Well, hummingbirds are smart enough to know to avoid bad sugar water.
Oh,
if it's rancid,
okay.
Or if it's gone, that it's fermenting,
yeah.
They'll steer clear.
Oh,
okay.
That's good.
So they're not hurting the birds. All right, Jake, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to 1-800-348-2551. It's Robert's turn. Robert and Troy, you're on.
Hello. I wanted to bring up, since they mentioned hummingbirds, I've seen with binoculars what looks like a moth that looks exactly like a hummingbird.
Yes.
Without binoculars, it looks just like a hummingbird. I wonder if you would know anything about this creature.
Yeah, actually, and coincidentally enough, it's called the hummingbird moth.
Okay, I'm writing this down.
That's one of them, but there are several that look
there
like...
There are several.
We had a gypsy moth, I believe, in the house. Not a gypsy moth, but a sphinx moth.
Sphinx moth,
that's looked, the one. We thought it was a hummingbird for the first 20 minutes. It was flying around inside our house.
Yeah, there's a whole variety of these sphinx moths that do look and act in many ways like a hummingbird. And in fact, that's some of the theories behind, the suggestions behind some of the very early hummingbird reports that we do get out there. The April hummingbirds are probably early emergent sphinx moths or other similar insect lookalikes.
Mm.
So, to me, it's a terrific convergence in evolution and lifestyles.
They're very beautiful. I don't know, are they going to cause any harm to anybody or anything like that?
Not at all. They do the same thing as hummingbirds do, but mostly at night. But there are diurnal sphinx moths out there. So, And others that will follow the same feeding behavior, and that is nectar from flowers, either
and
day
offering.
Or night.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, sir.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Now, I wonder, are hummingbird moths, will you see them around here? I know.
Oh, sure.
Again, we've seen a sphinx moth up close, and at first it was a little unsettling when it flew in our house.
Oh, I can understand, yeah.
But, I mean, they're big.
They're big, they're very active, they're hard to tame.
Well, they are hard to change.
Yes, right.
Much like my children. You know, the thing about these, what sort of evolutionary path allowed them to look so much like hummingbirds or vice versa?
And there had to have been an evolutionary advantage in that.
Yeah. What is the advantage?
Well, obviously what works for one works for the other. You know, we see so many of these parallels in nature. between flying birds and flying insects and flying fish and flying bats.
Yeah.
You know, there are advantages in some of these tricks that wild creatures use for survival. And others, you know, through evolutionary time, catch on and utilize them to their best advantage.
All right, let's get one more call in before the break here. We'll go to Marjorie in Saugerties. Hi, I'm Marjorie.
Hey, how are you, Ray?
Good, how are you?
I'm pretty good. My question for Rich is this. Someone gave me a dead black vulture.
Ow.
Why?
Ow.
Why?
Hit by a car.
Oh,
yeah. Ow. Twice.
And it's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
What shall I do with it?
Well,
I know I really am not supposed to have it.
You're right about that. And, and I'm not going to urge or suggest that you keep it. But if one were to, I would contact the New York State Museum in Albany.
Uh-huh.
Jeremy Kirchner might be interested in it. You know, it's kind of hard to put a big vulture someplace and keep it. But the State Museum or the Natural History Museum in New York City are two places that would be interested in hearing about it. Now, whether or not they want to latch on to it, we'll leave it up to them. The other one is a community college in Hudson, New York.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Cook there has all the proper permits and, federal authorizations to hold on to these things and use them for educational purposes.
Huh.
And
okay. Well, it's beginning to smell some.
Well.
Is it beyond?
No.
No?
No. Cook is a miracle maker when it comes to things like that. I have some... I have a salvage permit, and I have some horror stories that I can share, but I don't think I will.
I'm glad.
But I brought him to Cook, and he managed to excavate the best out of some of these things that I brought him.
Hey, Marjorie, was this a gift?
Because
yes. Very inventive. Yeah.
I love to collect skeletons of things because it's a way of making them live on, and I have a bunch of things.
Mm. Well, that's good
like,
spirit.
I have a crow head with a hawk. You know, hole in it.
Yeah.
Well,
don't we all?
Yes, everybody should. I have a coyote foot. You know, I have a whole bunch of things.
Marjorie, something
yes.
else.
What a great way to take a break, Marjorie.
Dr. Cook, wait. I need to know where I can reach him at.
I'll
please.
Give you a phone number. 518.
Yeah.
828. 4181.
4181. Thank you very much.
Marjorie, thanks for the most interesting call of the month. We appreciate it. Let's take a break here. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, we'll regroup. We'll be back.
Support comes from Oblong Books, presenting Storytime with Randall DeSev, reading her book Peanut and Fifi Have a Ball, Saturday, May 11th, 3 p.m. in Millerton. Oblongbooks.com. Washington County Tourism, featuring outdoor spring recreational activities, including fly fishing, artistic events, venues, and museums, WashingtonNYCounty.com. The Blue Rock Restaurant, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Chef Chris Ramirez creating new American cuisine and handcrafted desserts, wine and beer from local to worldwide, live jazz on Fridays. TheBlueRockRestaurant.com. And Kingsway Community Schenectady, offering a continuum of care and services to area seniors since 1975. Including rehabilitation and more. Caring in the family tradition, KingswayCommunity.com.
That's relaxing. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Rich Guthrie is our guest. Oh boy, it's Bird Day. And our producer, Patrick Donges, is here too. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Raymond. Hi, Rich. We've got quite a bit going on the social media. Let's see. Let's start with Robert on Facebook. Says, if we get the huge numbers of 17-year cicadas, can we expect to see a feeding frenzy by the birds, or do they have a natural defense like unpleasant taste?
Good question.
Good question. And, you know, we don't know the answer to that. And the reason I say that is because the question has been raised out there. And the theory that I've seen proposed is actually bird numbers actually go down when the cicada cycle comes around.
Why?
Don't know why, and of course this is a theory that has been postulated out there that remains to be seen. And this year will be a good telling opportunity to see. Then we'll have to wait 17 years to test the results
with
the next cycle.
All right.
Okay, we got V on Facebook. Says, I'm in Saratoga by the lake. I have a bald eagle that's been coming into my backyard where I have a big creek and collecting grass, mud, etc. There's a nest at our neighbor's house. I was wondering, since we see this eagle almost daily, are the numbers getting better? And how many pairs of nesting eagles are there in the area?
Okay, this is great.
Yes, it is. And Massachusetts just conducted their, I think, first annual bald eagle nesting survey.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up with some remarkable results. In New York, we do the survey back in the wintertime, although the DEC, New York State Environmental Conservation, used to do a flyover nest survey mm-hmm. in the past.
Yeah.
I think, first of all, the eagle has made a remarkable comeback and has been taken off the endangered species list because the numbers have increased so dramatically and successfully. And we all deserve congratulations for that. They are occupying more and more new nest territories each year. I don't know the current number in New York. I think it was 70 pairs in Massachusetts, according to their recent survey.
So something similar, you would say?
Oh, way higher in New York. We have way more habitat available with the Hudson River Valley, Lake Champlain, the St. Lawrence River, the Great Lakes, and the Niagara Frontier. We have way more opportunity for eagles to nest here in New York.
We got a couple more here. Tom at Saratoga Tom on Twitter asks, where are all the warblers this spring? They seem to be late.
Well, you're right, Tom. And again, this has to do with that. Let's hope that it's only the weather. And now, since we brought up the idea of the cicadas, maybe it has something to do with the cicadas, although I really doubt it.
No, they're not here yet, are they?
The cicadas are not here yet, but again, this person was talking about somehow a correlation between a long-term cycle of the cicadas and a long-term cycle of population dynamics in migrant birds.
Interesting.
I know. It seems pretty far-fetched. It's way out there, but that's what science does. It's every now and then, it takes a look at some far-out questions and says, maybe, and then we all get to work and say, let's see if or not.
So as far as you know, the warblers are on the way.
They're on their way. And this is news that they're late is news up and down the East Coast.
Okay.
I'm hearing this from New York City area, Long Island, New Jersey, and further south. Now I'm hearing today in Central Park in New York City, people are happy they're seeing songbirds, they're seeing the warblers.
Okay.
The wave is on its way.
Good.
All right, I'm going to combine these last two
because
they both are egg questions.
Okay.
Pamela on Facebook, that's facebook.com/WAMC radio, says the Christmas wreath on the front of the house got stuck on its hook and I couldn't get it down in January. Finally got around to trying again last weekend and I found a bird's nest with eggs behind it.
Uh-oh.
How long should I allow before trying again? I don't want to disturb the family, but I don't want to leave the wreath out all summer. A nice problem to have and I wish the birds luck. So that's the first question. The next question along similar lines is Edie via email at that's foxpop@wamc.org wants to know, how does a baby bird, a chick, breathe in the shell?
Oh,
yeah. Well, eggshells are porous. They need to take in air, oxygen, and also they need to have moisture that they exchange through the porous shell. And there is an air sac inside the shell that will also harbor some air. Then as far as the nest is concerned, a summer wreath, how lovely.
Yeah.
I would say brown summer wreath, I'm sure.
Big brown summer wreath, along with the rest of the neighbors. At least it's a wreath and not the lights and the icicles hanging from the ceiling.
Right.
But, you're going to have to give them a month. And congratulations. It's probably house finches. They're the ones that typically will nest in that sort of situation. And they're delightful singers and lovely little guys to have around. So congratulations. Good luck. And
so
thank you.
They'll hatch and they'll need about a month to hang out in the nest?
Between now and when they finally get up and go.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then take the wreath down if you really don't want to, because they might come back and try it again and have another brood.
So the next wreath, it could happen again. All right. Well, that's great. Patrick Donges, always a delight.
Always a delight. Same to you, Raymond.
The exit's there. And, we'll go to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. Saul in Schenectady. Saul, you're on.
Hi. Let's see. I bought a hummingbird feeder that attaches to the window with suction cups, and it's kind of close to the window. I'm concerned that, will the hummingbirds kind of smash themselves against the glass by accident? Should I get a feeder that hangs further out?
Well, I would recommend getting the one that hangs further out. Number one, it gives you a better opportunity to watch the birds from a little safer distance. But I don't believe a feeder on the window will entice the birds to fly in and bump against the glass. They're going to come in looking at that feeder as a place, as a destination. What does get the birds with respect to windows is the reflection of the woods behind the bird, where they're flying in looking for a perch that they think is 20 yards ahead of them, when actually there's nothing but a pane of glass there reflecting the perch that's 20 yards behind them.
Yeah.
And so they're flying in at high speed looking for that perch. So the hummingbird will be coming in with its landing gear down, ready to stop at the feeder. So I don't think that that will in itself be any greater detriment to the birds present.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, my gosh, that was a perfect answer. Thank you, and Saul, I appreciate it very much. Let's go to see if we can make it 2 for 2 with Rich here. Ben in Lee, Mass. Ben, you're on.
Hey, Rich, how are you?
Doing great.
That's good. I know you from Ingram's. I don't know if you...
Oh, of course, of course, sure. Yes. Hi, Ben. How's everything going? We'll chat offline, but go ahead.
Okay. Cicadas, is there a northern reach for them? Do they... Like, I've heard they only go up to Connecticut, or do they come into this area as well?
They'll be here.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, they'll all come at once?
They'll
be
all
like
come at once. They'll all come
thing?
Out at once. Yes, this is going to be dramatic, and it'll be deafening when they do arrive.
I don't remember 17 years ago when it happened last.
I do.
Really? Was it exciting?
Well, it was noisy. Drive down the highway, and you hear this constant buzz. It's like a tinnitus with steroids.
Ah. Well, maybe I do remember that.
And we'll see them in the Berkshires in Massachusetts?
I actually, Ben, I don't know how high up in elevation they will go, but bottom line, and for people who may be concerned, they actually do no harm. They do no harm. They'll eat some of the sap off the tree. But one of the remarkable things I remember from the last time is that they girdle a branch,
yeah,
the tip of a branch on a tree, and let the outer growth on that die off. The branch will snap off and come down like a parachute, a gently falling parachute, like a dart, where the tip will go into the ground.
Or somebody who happens to be underneath.
Well, wear a hard hat.
Yeah.
And that will inject the eggs back into the soil.
Wow.
I know.
Amazing.
I think that's what I saw. I'm going to look for that again.
He's making it up again, Ben.
There
I apologize.
Go.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, my man.
Let's go over to Lynn in Shelby Falls. Lynn, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Rich, I've got a question, but I thought of another question as well. But I've got a pair of hairy woodpeckers that, well, I never thought they turned like coffee, ice cream color, that they're white. Everywhere that's white has turned a kind of coffee ice cream color.
Okay.
That's not unusual? That's unusual.
Well, it's unusual, but it's only a stain. I'm going to say it's only a stain. There are some varieties, and I will say this. There are some dark forms of hairy woodpeckers, not around here. Pacific Northwest will have a coffee ice cream colored woodpecker. But I think that you got the two of them there.
Yeah.
Probably the wood inside the nest hole that they've chosen for this year.
Was it sappy or?
Sappy or brown colored.
Wow.
Wet and staining.
Will they wash?
Oh, sure.
Oh, okay.
It'll come off.
Interesting.
So let us know if they turn white again.
Yes. I thought it might be a development for summer. I got another question quickly. The house finch, purple finch thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a Peterson's guide that says there are no house finches.
Oh, well, that was, you need a newer guide.
Yes, I guess I do.
That was written back in 1947, before the house finches became an item.
Ah.
Now, what do you mean?
Well, they weren't here. House finches are illegal immigrants to the Northeast. They're residents of the Southwest.
I see.
Arizona, California, and that area. And they were imported into New York and released illegally, but have flourished ever since. And that was about the time that Peterson put out his field guide in 1947. And he just did not have the wherewithal to include them. And now they're here, and they're in each subsequent edition.
How different do they look from each other?
The house finch is slimmer than the purple finch. Mm-hmm. They are more rose-colored, whereas the purple finch is raspberry-colored. Mm. And the coloring on the male is more restricted to the head, the breast, and the rump.
Okay. Okay.
Whereas on a purple finch, it's more or less uniformly head all the way down. And the females have a finer streak. The female purple finch has coarse, broad blotches, whereas the female house finch has fine, dainty little spots stretched out into streaks.
Mm.
And the house finch has a beautiful song and do like houses. Purple finches, they're away in the woods.
I've got a lot of what I thought were purple finches out here with the and the females with the coarse stripes. And
well, where is Shelby Falls?
Shelburne, it's...
Oh, Shelburne. It says Shelby. I apologize.
It is kind of, that's right. It's well, I'm kind of out in the sticks here a little.
Okay, what county?
Franklin.
Oh, well, then purple finches.
Yes.
Okay.
One more tiny thing. Are there any Carolina chickadees up here?
Negative.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Hey, Lynn, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, it's a 1-800-348-2551. Sarah in Saugerties is on. Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have what I believe is the nest of an eastern seedy under the eaves of my house. They built one last year as well on my porch. And I periodically go up and with my phone and try and take a picture with my camera because I can't see in there without disturbing anybody. And yesterday I noticed that there are four white eggs and one beautiful blue and brown marbly-looking egg.
Oh, really?
So what does that mean?
It means that a cowbird has found your phoebe nest.
That's what my mother said.
Uh-huh.
Now what do I do? She's a bird enthusiast much more than I. Is there anything I should do? Or,
well,
I mean, are they going to hurt my little phoebes?
Yeah, they'll probably displace all of your little phoebes. Cowbirds, for those who may not, a lot of people know about cowbirds, but
I don't.
Okay.
Even though I know you've told me dozens of times.
Well,
we'll say it again.
Not a problem.
All right.
Cowbirds are parasites. They're brood parasites. The female cowbird does not build a nest, does not lay her eggs in her own nest, and the male does not defend the territory. The female cowbird will find somebody else, plop the egg down into that nest, and a baby cowbird hatches out sooner, grows larger, and is more aggressive than the host species babies. So the baby cowbird wins at the expense, usually, maybe one of the others might survive, but usually at the expense of the other nest mates. So legally, you can't do anything about it. It's against the law to disturb even the cowbird egg. So I'll leave it at that with you.
Okay.
You'll know that the female phoebe and the male phoebe do not know the difference and will feed the baby cowbird as if it were their own.
Oh, I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
It's a totally interesting evolutionary pathway that they have taken. It's a wonderful pathway if you're a cowbird.
Yeah.
But not if you're a song sparrow or phoebe or blue wing warbler or one of the guys that we like.
And they will hatch sooner than the phoebes, you think?
Yeah, that's the usual trend, is that they will hatch out sooner. They have a shorter incubation period and gives them, you know, that just one more advantage.
Amazing.
I know.
I'll have to keep my eyes out.
Nature is remarkable, and this is nature's own doing.
Right, yeah.
So, you know. We have to know that the laws are written by, not our fault.
Why do they call them cowbirds?
Oh, good question. Better be known as buffalo birds. Before the colonists arrived, they were more or less restricted to the Great Plains,
mm-hmm.
where they followed the buffalo herds. And this is probably where they picked up the habit of parasitizing other birds' nests.
So they just followed the buffalo for no reason?
Well, buffalo kick up a lot of good food, either in undigested grain or insects that they move along as they're feeding, ticks and other things. So they just coexist with the buffaloes and other large mammals. When the colonists came, cleared out the forest in the east and brought in cows and horses, said, works for me. I don't need buffalo no more. We'll stick around here.
I'll be darned.
So we did have a bit of an influence on their distribution, and a lot of the eastern birds were introduced to cowbird predation. In that respect, we did have a hand in that game.
All right, let's go get another call in here before the next break. And Kathy in Kingston. Kathy, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for a very interesting show.
Thank you.
I have a bird identification question. A few weeks ago, I was fortunate enough to see a falcon and I'd like to describe it, and so you could tell me what kind it is. I wasn't successful in looking online or in bird identification books, so I'm wondering if it may be an immature one. The bird was probably 11 to 14 inches bill to tail, tail tip, and it had a cream-colored breast, had that lovely charcoal black cap and this nice yellow hooked bill, and, but the back of it was a rusty brown color. And I believe, it, as I'm remembering, it had also, the wings were that charcoal black color. So could you help me with that? I'm sure it was a falcon. I'm just not sure what, which one.
Well, okay, starting out with if it was a falcon or not. Falcons are birds of prey with narrow pointed wings that were built, designed for fast flight.
Right. This one was in a tree, had landed in a tree.
That's okay. And the other thing about them is that they do like a conspicuous perch because they'll hang out there, wait for some prey to come by and go after it. From the size that you describe, it sounds to me like it might be a female American kestrel. And I don't know if you have the opportunity, but I'll hold Crosley's ID guide up. And
oh, yeah, there it is.
For
yeah.
the picture. And there, the female American kestrel has attributes that sound like your description, especially the size. The other possibility, given the size range, might be the Merlin, M-E-R-L-I-N,
right.
which is a newcomer falcon to the Northeast. They're moving into the area. They're becoming the new city or urban raptor. Will now nest in city environments such as Syracuse or Ithaca or Rochester, right. and perhaps Kingston, New York. So,
well, this was in an apartment complex development,
mm-hmm.
and she was smart enough to land within easy reach of a bird feeder.
Oh,
well, then. So that's a real possibility, and they're also migrating through, so it could have been just transient going from mm-hmm. south to north, where it will, depending on if it's a Merlin or a kestrel, nest further to the north of us.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. I was very excited.
Well, thank you, Kathy.
Kathy, thanks a lot for the call. We're going to take a break here, 1-800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie is our guest. We talk birds, 1-800-348-2551. More coming up.
Support comes from Albany Pro Musica, performing Haydn's Lord Nelson Mass with guest conductor Dr. Timothy Newton this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. at the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall. AlbanyProMusica.org. Binney Water Ice and Spring Water, Kingston. Pure Spring Water, Coffee Service, and Mountain Valley Spring Water delivered to homes and offices, local and family-owned, BinneyWater.com. Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and more, where eyewear is an art. Facebook or visionexceleyecare.com. And Dam Cafe and Deli, Saugerties, New York, serving breakfast and lunch with chef-created soups, salads, vegetarian options, and homemade desserts. Catering services available. TheDamCafeAndDeli.com.
So the lockbox is open. Now, you know, the fund drive starts, I believe, on June 3rd. That's Monday, June 3rd. And what we attempt to do with the lockbox is to get the fund drive in high gear before we even start. Last time we knocked a couple of days off the drive, and we're trying to do that or better this time. So if you want to make a pledge now, everything counts on day one. So far, $79,563 in the lockbox. And if you want to make your pledge, you go to WAMC.org. Click on the little picture of the locked box, whatever you want to call it, and make your pledge, and we'll thank you. We'll thank you on day one of the drive, which I believe is June 3rd. So let's get that lockbox filled up and shorten the fun drive. Patrick Donges is here, our producer. Hello again.
Hello.
Oh, we'll turn his microphone on.
Yes.
There
hello.
It is. Hi, Patrick.
we got a couple questions here. Marcia on Facebook. How do I discourage blue jays from completely taking over the bird feeders and scaring off most of the other birds? And another question, what's the difference between black oil sunflower seeds and striped sunflower seeds?
Okay.
Question number two.
Oh, we'll turn your mic on, too. You know, let's just turn everyone's mic on.
Am I there?
Hang on.
No, hold on. We've got some technical difficulties, perhaps.
Okay. Now I think, hello. Testing 1, 2.
Check, please.
Here we go. The question number two first, and that is black oil versus striped sunflower seed.
Yes.
No difference.
Okay.
Except a good friend of mine did a study some years ago and said that he likes the black oil sunflower seed because it takes the birds a little longer to get at the seed, and they have to earn their keep a little more.
Okay.
And it keeps them a little busier.
Okay.
Now, question number one, I forgot.
The blue jay and how nasty they are, and how do you keep them away?
Two things. Number one, they like gold.
What?
They like gold.
The color?
The color gold.
Okay.
Oh. So what you want to do for the blue jays is put some cracked corn.
Yeah.
Looks like gold to them.
Sure.
And that'll keep them, and you can put that on the ground. And the blue jays will like to go after that first.
Presumably you put that on the neighbor's lawn?
No. Keep them close to home.
I think they want to get rid of them, right?
No, they want them there, but not to hog the feeder.
Just not completely taking over.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, they keep the chickadees and nuthatches away. That's okay. The neighbors will appreciate it if you do that. But in any event, yeah, put some crack corn on the ground if you can stand it, and the blue jays will love you for that. And then a little smaller bird feeder where the blue jays can't perch would also be a good technique. There are feeders that are designed specifically for things like goldfinches and chickadees and nuthatches and the like.
Okay. Maud, via email, okay. voxpop@wamc.org, says, regarding heron rookery, there is an active rookery, and I will not disclose the location.
That's
because
good.
Says there are approximately 6 active nests on site. I'm not sure if this should be shared on air, as it is a quiet rural area. Eagles are active in the area as well. And as we discussed a moment ago, it should not be shared on air.
Well, yeah, that's my take on it.
Okay.
Number one, there are plenty enough eagle rookeries around. I mean, heron rookeries around for people to observe.
Yeah.
So that, you know, if you got one over there tucked away in a corner of your neighborhood, that's fine. Enjoy them. Be respectful of the and people can look elsewhere. They can find them plenty enough out there. So, Maud, congratulations and thank you for that.
Yeah, there's an article in LoHUD, I believe it was just a few days ago, about one in Bedford. And if they gave the article and the location there, presumably it's okay to look at.
Yes, but they are pretty resilient and can stand their ground when it comes to a moderate amount of attention,
okay.
But certainly not any kind of disturbance.
All right. Well, our producer, Patrick Donges. All right. You're clear to turn off Patrick's microphone now. Patrick, thanks very much. Oh, you see, they turned your mic off so long. All right. Back to the phones we go. 1-800-348-2551. Harriet in Woodstock. Harriet, you're on.
Hi, Ray.
Hello.
Well, here's the thing. There was a wonderful interview on WAMC this earlier in the week with Joe Donahue, and a woman who had written a book about saving an eagle, Saving Mitch, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about that?
Was it a local interview or was it a network interview?
No, it was Joe.
Oh,
Joe,
I'm sure it's on the roundtable page here. I'm right on the website. I'll see.
Well,
you talk to Rich, and I'll try to find it for you.
Well, Rich, it was about a woman who had written a book and had taken part in the rescue of an eagle that was shot in Afghanistan.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And it's a wonderful story of a group effort and all kinds of people becoming involved in rescuing the bird. And it's now at a sanctuary in this country.
Okay.
And I forgot exactly where, but it's in the Northeast. It's in New England, I think.
Well, the one sanctuary I know about around here where that does harbor eagles that can't be released back to the wild. There's Berkshire Bird Paradise.
That's it.
Yes. Aha. And that's in Rensselaer County, New York.
Yes.
Roughly out Route 2 east of Troy, between Troy and the Bennington, Vermont area.
Okay.
Berkshire Bird Paradise.
Bird Paradise, that's it. Well, the thing I wanted to mention particularly was how wonderful that story was and the fact that our Senator Schumer was instrumental in getting that bird
his safety.
Well, it's a, you know, it's a shame that our wildlife worldwide has to suffer the suffer through the foibles of humankind.
Yeah.
And I cringe when I hear, you know, we know the troubles that people have, and I am very concerned about that. But you know, it spills over into the wildlife of the world, and so many of our innocent creatures out there are suffering from these behavioral activities. And I, you know, it's good to see that there is a caring effort put into one of the victims of this folly.
Yes.
And, you know, if I were you and other listeners who appreciate the effort, you know, drop Senator Schumer a note and just, you know, say thank you for your effort on that.
All right.
Yes, that's part of the reason that I was calling. For
there
that,
you go.
You know, to say thank you to him. And also, the idea, just wanted to say that people think if you help and care for wildlife that you don't help and care for people, but it's not a, it's not an either or. You can do both.
I'm with you there, and
yeah.
I wish we could do more for both.
And I appreciate the call very much. The book, by the way, is Saving Eagle Mitch, and you can learn all about that. Hear the interview with the author at Barbara Chapatis, I believe it is, and it's on the Roundtable page. So you go to wamc.org/roundtable and scroll down a bit. It was on Tuesday, I think, and you'll hear Joe's interview there. All right, back to the phones we go. We go to Greta. Love the name Greta. I have a daughter named Greta. Presumably that's not you. Hello.
No, it's not. Thank you for taking my call. I have had a house wren built a small a nest in a basket out on the midst wall in front on the side of my front door. I have been away for 2 days, came home, the nest is gone or it's closed up, and then I saw on the floor here 4 of them dead, mother dead, and 3 others, and the heads are cut off.
Ow. Oh,
yes,
Greta.
I'm so upset and I'm so sad.
And you know that these were house wrens? Was
that's what I figured out from my book.
Oh, that's very unusual. Well,
teeny ones with a kind of long, thin beak, and there were 5 eggs in there, kind of speckled eggs.
Yeah.
And they hatched, and now they're dead.
Yeah. Well, obviously some predator found its way in there. And, you know, that's one of the risks of bird nesting, and the birds might have chosen your location for the protection that you offer them vicariously. And you know, one of the things about bird nesting, I'm not saying that this is what happened there. I don't want to put a guilt trip on you, but if a nest is there, it's a good idea to steer clear of it in the house, on a shrub, in a tree, on the grass. Because animals during the night, marauding animals, will follow scent trails. And by handling or just moving the branches or doing something of that sort could lead one of these blundering beasts right up to the nest.
But there's nothing. There's no bushes, nothing. It's just a plain basket in the middle of my wall.
Yes.
And it's in the corner and it's very protected.
Yes, but chipmunks, you know, scurry around, or gray squirrels and red squirrels.
Are they carnivores as well?
Oh, they will be. They're opportunists. They'll take what they can. And in fact, I was just reading an article, I think it was in New York Times, that it was chipmunks that were causing a study that some folks had done in national parks, where chipmunks being fed in the campgrounds were devastating some of the ground nesting bird species.
Wow.
There.
So
but they had to jump to get up there.
They do that. They have.
They do that?
They do that. And then there are other potential possibilities, too. It sounds to me like a predator got in there. And
what kind? That's what I'm kind of.
Oh, that I don't know. It would be hard to say. The most nutritious part of something like that would be the head. So that, you know, the birds will go after that.
Really?
Cannibalism. I feel so sad.
Well, I'm with you on the sadness part. And let's hope that birds have it in their system that they'll make another attempt and have a successful brood next time around.
Well, right, sorry about that, Greta.
Yeah, thank you. I've just been following it from day to day, and I was looking forward to grow up and fly.
Well, I hope the next brood will do that.
Okay, thank you so much.
Oh, you're
Thanks,
quite welcome.
Greta. Let's go to Peter in Schenectady. Hiya, Peter, you're on.
Yes, hi. just for your heron lovers out there who can't get to a rookery, I just wanted to mention the Cornell Heron webcam.
Ah, good man, yeah.
And there's five eggs, and the 24-hour-a-day cam is right on the nest.
You're right. And you can look, you can sit back in the comfort of your own home and watch the herons at the rookery at the Cornell website. It's a lovely.
Right, they can just search for Cornell herons, and you'll find it.
Yeah, there
Brilliant.
You go. Cornell, H-E-R-O-N.
Thank you.
Yeah, Peter, thanks a lot.
I appreciate that call, Peter.
So there you go. And you do you still have your blog and whatnot,
Rich? You know, I do. We have some technical, you know, how the
still
microphone...
Still you have technical difficulties?
Yes. I'm talking to the guy down there, and I just emailed him this morning. I said, come on, let's get together on this thing here. I got a new camera, and I'm all excited. I want to put some new pictures out there, and I'm chafing at the bit.
I mean, you know, it was a month ago you had technical difficulties. All right, I'm just saying.
All right. You know,
play here. You want me to make a call? You want me to call the guy?
Can you help me?
We might be able to twist a couple arms. 1-800-348-2551. Rosie in Albany. Rosie, you're on.
Hi. I had a question about Eastern towhees. Do we have them in our area?
Rosie, yes.
Ah. And also, that sort of leads into my next question.
Okay.
Is there any way to encourage the larger birds to feed at your feeder, like the grosbeaks and... towhees. Is there any way to bring them in?
Really, not quite that easy. You know, it's a funny thing about that. Our summer birds that come up from south, the towhee from a little south, and the grosbeaks from further south, and the indigo buntings and the like, they like the same food that our winter birds like, but they're a little reluctant to come to feeders on a regular basis. And the best way to do it is a platform feeder, a flat top feeder that's elevated, mm-hmm. let's say on a post or where they can get to. The towhee is more of a ground feeder, and they like a lot of shrubbery around. I think they will be harder pressed to find a towhee at a feeder. But the rose-breasted grosbeak, for example, will come to a feeder. And for some reason, they'll visit it for just a few days in early spring and then move on. Same mm-hmm. with the indigo bunting. I know a few people have had rose-breasted grosbeaks spend the entire summer. In fact, bring the whole family to the feeder during the course
wow,
of the summer.
Lucky.
Yeah, but
treat.
that's few and far between. And I don't know the mechanism that entices some and not others. So both of them are in the area. You can and if you want to see towhees, the best place in the Albany area that I can recommend is the Albany Pine Bush. A walk through the Albany Pine Bush will bring a resounding song of towhees to your ear.
Okay. Rosie,
all
thanks
right, well,
a lot.
Check that out.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Robin in Cambridge. Robin, you're on.
Yes, hi. I just have a follow-up to the hummingbird moth question. I had one in my garden, and I was very interested in it and did a little research and found out that it is actually the moth of the tomato hornworm.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you know what that is, but it's a big green caterpillar that's like the size of your finger.
I know. They're lovely, aren't they?
And, you know, you see one on your tomato plant and you think it's an alien or something because it's so big. And I always, you know, whenever I saw them, I would smush them because I thought, how dare they eat my tomatoes? But now that I know it turns into a hummingbird moth, I let them eat.
Yeah, and there's, you know, a little bit off topic, but there's another interesting aspect of the tomato hornworm is that there's a parasitic wasp that will lay its eggs on the on that caterpillar.
And, I have seen that.
You have, and you know,
I have.
Isn't that, it's remarkable how nature works in
know,
so many ways.
I saw that, and because I was letting it, you know, I was looking out for them, and then I saw one with the white things on it, and
yeah.
I looked that up too and found that out. So yeah, it is fascinating.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not a happy day for the caterpillar, I'll tell you that.
Absolutely not.
But
you either get smushed or you get a wasp on you.
Yeah.
You know.
But thank you for that, Robin.
Robin, thanks
okay.
a lot.
Thanks a lot.
All right, let's do, tell you what, Randy, we have about a minute for you, okay? Maybe a little bit more, and go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You're on.
Hello?
You're on.
Hi. Listen, I'm out here in Mohawk Valley, and I'm always seeing hawks out here that are being chased by smaller birds, like blackbirds or starlings. I mean, like, they're like, sometimes it's just one or two, and often it's, like, huge flocks of birds are chasing these hawks.
Well, that's all about the nesting birds. They want to keep the raptors and predators and the bullies away from their nest site. So the little guys will go up after the big guys. The hummingbirds will chase the jay will chase the crow, and the crow will chase the hawk, and the hawk will chase the eagle. It's a reverse pecking order, and it's all about protecting their babies.
All right, Randy, we're out of time, but thank you, my friend. All right, now you have an announcement.
I do. I'd like to make an there are some folks out there that have lawns and hay fields that they want to share with their local farmer.
Yeah.
And the question is all about mowing and the sequence of mowing to protect the ground nesting birds.
Yes.
And the best bet is a couple of tricks or techniques that the Albany, New York, Audubon, New York has.
Yeah.
I recommend going to their site.
Okay.
But it's all about timing. July 1st, preferably July 15th, or better yet, August 1st.
So just don't mow your lawn except on those days?
But we love our dairy farmers, and we know they need the early mowing to stay in business.
Yeah.
And mow from the inside out. Give those guys a chance to get away from the rather than confining them to the center strip.
Okay. And, Rich, that'll have to do it today.
Yes.
But thanks to you, and thanks to everybody who called in today. And support comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York. Women-owned and operated with a combined 70 years' experience. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. The Alternative Baker, Rosendale, artisan all butter baked goods made from scratch, handcrafted lemon velvet cakes and egg sandwiches daily, where taste is everything, lemoncakes.com. And Performance Automotive, Pittsfield, a European and Saab service center serving Western Massachusetts and the greater capital Albany market for 25 years. Saab, it's not just a car, it's a passion. Saabperformance.com. Thanks to Zach Malloy for handling the controls, turning the mics on, turning the mics off. Thanks to Matt Don Diego, our intern. He handled the phones today, and I got to tell you, it's his last day. He's back to his parents' couch for the next couple of years. He did a great job. Moyers and Company tomorrow, Medical Monday next week, and stay tuned for a news update.